Good morning. We're going to jump right into it today. Chapter 24 of Matthew is a bit long, and there's a lot of stuff in there. So I would encourage you to turn there in your Bibles, take some notes if you want. I take a lot of notes in mine, especially when we're talking about prophecy. So I encourage you to do that. While you're turning there, I'm going to pray. Lord, I thank you for the prophecy. It's not my favorite topic. It's not easy to teach. It's not easy to understand. And yet it's an important part of your word. So I pray that we can understand it today. I pray that we can sort through what it is that you were talking about there on the Mount of Olives, and then how we can apply that to our lives. I pray this in Jesus' name. Amen. All right, so we are in our study in Matthew. We are finally in the last week of Jesus' life. We've seen him come into Jerusalem. We've seen him confront the religious leaders. We've seen him argue with them and debate with them and give them some warnings that we talked about last week. And now they've kind of given up on trying to trap him in debates. He's not talking publicly anymore. He's done with that for the rest of his stay on earth. And instead, what we see today is that he's talking with his disciples in a more private setting. This is on the Mount of Olives is where he is. And so this is the beginning of what's called the Olivet Discourse. And it's in Matthew, Mark, and Luke. And so we're going to be taking a look at a couple of different passages. We'll glance at Luke real quick at the beginning, too. The reason I want to do that, though, is because each one of the authors kind of it focuses on different things. And so as we go through this, we're going to take a look at Jesus' purpose for giving prophecy, the Bible's purpose for having prophecy in it, and then also trying to understand some of the prophecy that he gives us in this passage. And then I think more importantly, we need to talk about what we do with it. Why would he give it to us, and what are we supposed to do with that? And one of the other things I want to do is talk about some of the preconditions of these prophecies. I'm reluctant to teach on prophecy. I don't like doing it because I think it can be distracting. I think a lot of times people can get hooked into this and they start looking into prophecy and trying to understand things. And I think if God wanted it to be super understandable, he would have made it so. There's a reason it's a little cloudy. I think a lot of times when people teach on prophecy, they think, well, these are the end days. They teach that this is the end of time. And you know what? Maybe it is and maybe it isn't. Every generation has thought they were going to be the last one, I think, since Jesus' day. I know for one thing, for a fact, is that we're closer now than Matthew was, right? And so we're going to look at some of the things that Matthew recorded that Jesus said. He says some things that might have really seemed crazy to them that today, maybe not so much. And it's not so hard to imagine these days, some of these things. So we'll take a look at that. Not that these are end days, but that things are falling into place now like they never have before. So let's get into the passage. This is Matthew 24. Jesus came out from the temple and was going away when his disciples came up to point out the temple buildings to him. And he said to them, "Do you not see all these things? Truly I say to you, not one stone here will be left upon another, which will not be torn down." As he was sitting on the Mount of Olives, the disciples came to him privately, saying, "Tell us, when will these things happen, and what will be the sign of your coming and the end of the age?" And so these disciples, they're leaving the temple area, and they're starting to do the touristy thing. Look at this, look at that. Like they'd never been there before. And they had been. Jesus had been there before too. Even as a child, he'd been there. And yet, they're still, it's not that they're hicks, it's that it really was a pretty magnificent thing to look at. They in Mark, he points out, they point out the stones. Look at these enormous stones that they used to build the temple. And Jesus seizes on that idea. You know, these stones aren't that great. Pretty soon, not one's going to be standing on top of another. They're going to be taken down. And so he's telling them that eventually this temple is going to be torn to pieces. And so they latch onto that because they think that this is, maybe this is it. Maybe he's finally going to tell us when he's going to come into power, because they really wanted him to come and be the king. And they still weren't getting the fact that that's not why he was here the first time around. And so they ask him really two questions. They say, when will these things happen, and what will be the sign of your coming at the end of the age? And so they're really asking him two questions. In their minds, I'm sure it was one question. They thought, well, okay, the destruction of the temple, that's got to happen at the end of time when the Messiah comes and rules the world. And so they're asking him when that's going to happen. And Jesus knows that that's really two questions. There's going to be the destruction of the temple, and then later on, there's going to be the end when he comes as king. And so he answers both questions. Matthew, in this passage we're looking at today, really only focuses on the answer to the second question, what will be the signs of the end of the age? And so what I want to do, though, is take a look at Jesus' answer to the first question for a few minutes, because it's important to understand that, because the first question gets answered quickly. It's a near-term prophecy. In other words, it happens sooner than the other part, the other answer. And so we can look at that and say, all right, this is what Jesus predicted near-term. Did that happen? And if so, maybe we should pay attention to what happens, to what he says about the other question that's going to be in our future. So that's what we're going to do. We're going to take a quick look at Luke 21. This is where Luke records his answer to the first question. It says, when you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, then recognize that her desolation is near. Then those who are in Judea must flee to the mountains, and those who are in the midst of the city must leave, and those who are in the country must not enter the city, because these are days of vengeance, so that all things which are written will be fulfilled. And they will fall by the edge of the sword, and they'll be led captive to all the nations, and Jerusalem will be trampled underfoot by the Gentiles until the times of the Gentiles are fulfilled. So Jesus is saying this is when the temple is going to get destroyed. And he says, you're going to see it coming. He gives them some things to look for. He says, Jerusalem is going to be surrounded by armies. And then when that happens, people need to flee to the mountains. This is kind of odd advice. Usually when an army was coming in, people would run to the cities. The cities were fortified. The cities had walls. Cities had armies of their own to protect themselves. So when the armies were coming to invade, people would run towards the cities. He's saying something odd. He's giving them weird advice. Get out of the cities. Go to the mountains. In fact, he says, if you're in the city, you got to get out of there. You should leave the city. He tells them, you must not go into the city at all. So why is he giving them this weird advice? These armies are going to come. They're going to surround Jerusalem. And he says, get out of the city. It sounds like he's telling them to flee from safety. But it turns out what he's telling them is this army, what happens is armies would come and they would lay siege to a place with walls, like Jerusalem. Jerusalem was well defended. They had wall around the city. And so it was easier for an army to surround the city, cut off all their supplies, and just wait and let them starve. And eventually the people would come out. That worked sometimes. Sometimes it didn't. Sometimes the armies would break themselves against the walls and they wouldn't get through. But Jesus is saying this army will be successful. This is going to happen. And in fact, we know that it happened. In 66 AD, the Romans had finally grown tired of all the riots and all the rebellion that was going on in Jerusalem. And they brought their armies, and they did exactly what Jesus said they were going to do. They surrounded Jerusalem. And a lot of Christians at this time got out. They wouldn't fight. They knew they were going to lose because of what Jesus said here. And in fact, they got a lot of flack for that because they knew that they were going to lose, so they fled the city, as Jesus gave them that advice to do so. And so this happened, and in 4 years later, in 70 AD, Jerusalem fell. Rome came in. They took Jerusalem apart. Here is a picture. These are stones. This is a picture from Jerusalem today. This is the stones from the temple are still there, just sitting there, because it's hard to get the scale from this picture. There's huge stones, and so they're not moving them anywhere. They tore them apart. Not one stone was standing on another. It's interesting how that prophecy was fulfilled, because normally they wouldn't take every individual stone off. They would wipe the people out. They'd deport them, which is what happened. but they would leave the buildings because new people would have to come in and live with them. Well, the temple, though, they would set fire to it because there was a lot of wood and stuff in the temple. And then there got this rumor going around the Roman soldiers that the gold in the temple got so hot that it melted, and that it melted in between the cracks in the stones because they didn't use mortar back then. They just stacked these heavy stones on one another. And so the rumor was there was gold in between the stones of the temple because it had all melted in there. So the soldiers went in there and literally took every stone apart looking for that gold. And so Jesus' prophecy that not one stone would be standing on top of another came true. It's pretty amazing. This is a near-term prophecy. People who heard Jesus say that, some of them may have still been alive when this happened. He predicted what was going to happen. The Romans were going to come in, surround Jerusalem, and tear the temple down piece by piece. And he said then that the people were going to be led captive into all the nations, and Jerusalem was going to be trampled underfoot by Gentiles, non-believers, until the time of the Gentiles are fulfilled. So he's saying, not only is this a near-term prophecy that Jerusalem is going to be destroyed, Israel is going to be scattered among the nations, which is what Rome used to do. They were very efficient. When a group of people caused them problems, people that they'd conquered, they'd wipe them out, deport all the people, scatter them around, and then they just, what did that happen? Well, they just became Romans. They just became Romans because they were scattered all over the nation. Well, interestingly enough, I mean, this was very effective. You don't know what a lot of Philistines these days. I don't know any Moabites or Hittites. Romans were very good at this. And yet, still, we have Jerusalem. We still have the Jewish nation. They maintain their culture. They maintain their identity, even though they were scattered by the Romans in 70 AD. And then in 1948, they came back to Jerusalem. Isn't that amazing? It's never happened. 1900 years. It took them, and they remained a nation. Jesus said they were going to be gone until a specific time, and now they're back. How could that happen? That's a pretty bold prophecy. People used to read that, and they would think, well, clearly Jesus was smoking something because that's not working. That's never going to happen. Israel hasn't been Israel for centuries. And all of a sudden, in 1948, not only do we have Israel, but they also have control of Jerusalem. Amazing. So, Jesus had a prediction, a near-term prediction, to answer their first question, when will this thing happen, the temple being destroyed? And we know that it happened, just as he said it would. Not only did that temple get destroyed, he also said that they're going to come back, Israel's going to come back as a nation and have control of Jerusalem again. And that has happened in our history. So if Jesus is that accurate with the first question, maybe we need to pay attention to what he has to say with the second half that's going to take place in our future. So let's read on in Matthew 24. It says, Jesus answered them, and he said, see to it that no one misleads you, for many will come in my name, saying, I am the Christ, and they will mislead many. You will be hearing of wars and rumors of wars. See that you are not frightened, for those things must take place, but that is not yet the end. For nation will rise against nation and kingdom against kingdom, and in various places there will be famines and earthquakes, but all these things are merely the beginning of birth pangs. So Jesus is telling them, don't be misled. He's warning them not to be misled. I'm going to tell you the answer to this question so that you don't get fooled. There's a purpose behind me telling you this. People are going to be coming to my name saying, I am the Christ. That's not identity theft. That's not what's going on here. Christ isn't his name. It's his title. People were going to come along and say they're the Messiah and that they're going to lead away many people. And that has happened in history. Then he says, you'll be hearing of wars and rumors of wars. You see, war and rumors of war, people, every time there's a big war, people start to wonder, is this it? Is this the end? World War I came around, the war to end all wars, they called it. It was crazy big. 17 million people died in World War I. They called it The War to End All Wars, but it was so popular they had a sequel. World War II came around. Everybody thought this is the end. This has got to be it. This is the first time when nuclear weapons were used in wartime. The death toll for World War I was 17 million. World War II was 50 to 80 million. 50 to 80 million people. The reason there's a range there is because if you're only counting the people who were killed in combat, it's 50. But if you count all the people who starved and who died from their wounds or who died from disease that happened because of the devastation, that goes up to 80 million people. We've gotten really good as a race at killing each other. And Jesus says, don't be misled. Not every war is a sign of the end. There are going to be wars. There's going to be rumors about wars. There's going to be people, is this going to happen? Is that going to happen? Are we going to have a war with those folks? Is this going to be World War III? Don't be misled. He says they're going to have nations rising against nations and kingdoms against kingdoms in various places. There's going to be famines and earthquakes. It's interesting that he says this because the thing about biblical prophecy is that it's specific. We saw Jesus was very specific about what was going to happen to Jerusalem and that Jerusalem was going to be destroyed and that it was going to come back. Very specific. If you look at Daniel, Daniel prophesies to the month when Jesus is going to come into Jerusalem and be crucified. It's very interesting stuff. It's very specific. And yet here's Jesus saying things like various places. There's going to be wars and kingdoms and people are going to be fighting with each other. This is not part of the prophecy. He's telling them, this is a part of the warning. Don't be misled. You live in a broken world. Humanity is broken as a whole. There's going to be wars. Kingdoms are going to fight with each other. And the planet is broken. There's going to be earthquakes. There's going to be famines. It happens everywhere, in various places. This is part of the warning to not be misled. He says these things are just the beginning of birth pangs. Now, I've never given birth, but I've seen it done. And the way birth pangs work, from what I understand, is that they start small, but they get more frequent and more intense. So if anything that he's warning us about here is that there's going to be wars, there's going to be famines, there's going to be earthquakes. He might be saying that they're going to get more intense and more frequent as the end comes. It's going to get worse before it gets better, in other words. So don't be misled. There's going to be wars, there's going to be famines, there's going to be earthquakes. We live in a broken world. So then he has to say something about the actual prophecy. He says, they will deliver you to tribulation. This is not a good prophecy. They will kill you, and you will be hated by all nations because of my name. At that time, many will fall away and be betrayed one another, and betray one another and hate one another. Many false prophets will rise and will mislead many. Because lawlessness increased, most people's love will grow cold. But the one who endures to the end, he will be saved. The gospel of the kingdom shall be preached in the whole world as a testimony to all the nations, and then the end will come. All right, so now we've got some real specifics. He tells them this. They will be delivered into tribulation, and they will be killed, and they will be hated by the nations because of his name. Now, who's he talking about here? Is he talking specifically just to the disciples? We do know that the disciples were killed. All of them except John were martyred for their faith. John got away with a mild rebuke by being exiled to a salt mine on Patmos in his old age. That's not really getting away with anything there. People hated them. In fact, the Christianity was persecuted in a way that you could not believe in the first century. The Romans didn't like them because the Christians wouldn't admit that Caesar was God. The Jews didn't like them because they said that Jesus was the Messiah. And so the Romans and the Jews both persecuted the church. They tried really hard for 400 years to stamp out this new religion, and all it did was grow. All it did was expand to the point where it was recognized as a true religion by Rome in 400. And now it is the biggest religion in the world. It's astonishing. So I don't know that he's talking specifically to the disciples here. The disciples certainly went through this, but it's not new. We in our country, I think we forget about the persecution of Christianity that happens in all the nations. The most we get here as Christians is people look at us as backwards, maybe regressive. Perhaps maybe they think of Christians as judgmental. We might face some name calling or something like that. Last year, more Christians were martyred for their faith around the world than any other year since Christianity began. More Christians were killed last year for their faith than ever before. We don't get this. I don't think we see it. The media doesn't report it because it doesn't happen in America. It's not happening to Americans, and apparently that's the only thing we care about, so we don't hear about it. But this is going on today, right now. Christians are being murdered for their faith. Jesus is not lying that this was going to happen. It talks about many false prophets are going to arise and mislead many. There's going to be lots of false teaching. That was a big deal. Just almost every book in the New Testament talks about false teachers and warns people against false teachers and false prophets. There are going to be charismatic people coming, and what they say is going to be interesting. It's going to be compelling. And you've got to be careful because you need to pay attention to the truth. You need to know what the truth of the Bible is. That way when people come and they say something else, you can recognize it. So this has been a warning. This is a warning throughout the New Testament. He says lawlessness will increase, and then most people's love will grow cold. This word lawlessness could also be translated as anarchy. Just people, the whole idea of right and wrong breaking down. In Jesus' day, it was very cut and dry what was right and what was wrong. The idea that would break down was foreign to them, and yet here we are today. What's right for you is right for you. What's right for me, what's right for me. You can't tell me what's right. I can't tell you what's right. We don't have the right to tell each other what's right. This is happening right now, and more than any other culture in history. And he talks about love growing cold because we don't even know what love is anymore. When Jesus talks about love, it's talking about sacrificing for yourself to serve someone else. Excuse me. And yet, we think of love as just being nice. We think friendships are what we have on Facebook. That's what we think. Our love has grown cold because we don't even know what love is anymore. Because we don't know what right is and what's right and what's wrong. I think that this is feasible. That the more that breaks down, the more our love for one another is going to grow cold. And then he says something that must have been astonishing to these 12 guys in 33 AD. He says, the gospel of the kingdom, this is the message of Christ, will be preached in the whole world as a testimony to all the nations, and then the end will come. So before the end, the gospel is going to be taught in every nation. Now, they didn't even have a really strong concept of what the world was back then. They thought Mediterranean, and then there's other stuff, and then there's really fuzzy stuff farther out. They didn't really know. And yet, he's saying that the gospel will be taught in the whole world. How would that happen when everybody has to go everywhere on foot? And yet now we live in an age where information can be transmitted across the world in a matter of minutes. That people can travel around the world in a matter of hours. It's not so far-fetched now that this would happen. In fact, Peter says that the faster this happens, the sooner this happens, the sooner Christ will return. And so when he's talking about nations here, he's not talking about nation states that we think of nations like where there's lines on a map. He's talking about the word ethnoi is the word he uses here for nations. Is ethnic groups, individual groups of people who speak their own language and their own dialect, and the gospels are going to be taught to each of them. And then the end will come. That's pretty interesting because that it's a lot more complex than that. Right now, Christianity has been taught in every nation. But in every ethnic group, there are people who have not been reached by the gospel. Although, if you study these kinds of things, it's conceivable that that could happen in a matter of a few decades. In our lifetime, it could happen. Yet to them, I can't even imagine what they were thinking. Especially when you consider that Jesus, when he was put on the cross, there were about 120 people left that called themselves followers of Christ. 120. And from that group, in the midst of this worst persecution, it's grown now to the largest faith in the world. They had no idea that this was possible. And yet now it's not so hard to conceive. Then he says something really interesting. Now we're getting down to details. He says, therefore, when you see the abomination of desolation, which was spoken of through Daniel the prophet, standing in the holy place, let the reader understand. Then those who are in Judea must flee to the mountains. Whoever is on the housetop must not go down to get the things that are in his house. Whoever is in the field must not turn back to get his cloak. But woe to those who are pregnant and to those who are nursing babies in those days. Pray that your flight will not be in the winter or on Sabbath. Then there will be great tribulation, such as had not occurred since the beginning of the world until now, nor ever will. Unless those days have been cut short, no life would have been saved. But for the sake of the elect, those days will be cut short. So now he's saying there's an event that's going to occur. And that's when you know that the end is coming. That event here is the abomination of desolation. He says it's spoken of through Daniel. This abomination of desolation, here's the passage in Daniel that talks about it. In Daniel 9:27, he says, he is this figure that's going to come in the end of time, this Antichrist. He will make a firm covenant with the many. The many is Israel, for 1 week, that week being 7 years. But in the middle of the week, he will put a stop to the sacrifice and grain offering. And on the wing of abominations will come one who makes desolate, even until a complete destruction, one that is decreed, is poured out on the one who makes desolate. So here we have this figure. He's a world leader. He's very charismatic. He's called the Antichrist because he's anti-Christian. And people are going to follow him, and he's going to make this 7-year-long treaty with Israel. And he's going to come in, and halfway through that treaty, he's going to desecrate the temple. Now, this should wake us up a little bit, because Jesus has already just said that the temple was going to be destroyed, and it was destroyed, okay? And it has not been rebuilt yet. So, before this happens, they're going to have to not only rebuild the temple, but they're also going to have to start animal sacrifices and grain offerings again before this happens. Now, there are those who want to rebuild the temple. There are those who are working towards that end in Israel who want the temple to be rebuilt. They've been gathering materials. They've been working on the robes and such for the priests. They've even been breeding the flocks for the sacrifices. There's a movement in Israel to make this happen, to rebuild the temple. Hasn't happened yet. Now, when that does happen, and I said when, because I'm sure that Jesus knows what he's talking about, when that does happen, that does not mean it's the end of time. That just means one step closer. It's not until this abomination of desolation, this where the temple is desecrated, that then we know that the end is coming. So that could happen. I mean, the temple could be rebuilt, and the sacrifices could start again, and it could last for decades. Or it could last for a week. We don't know. But we do know that the temple is going to have to be rebuilt. And it wouldn't be the first time. That temple has been rebuilt a couple of times already. Then he talks about this great tribulation. This is a theme that comes up in biblical prophecy, talking about the end times. Daniel talks about this great tribulation. It's talked about here. It's talked about in Revelation. It's the 7-year period right before the end, before Christ returns. Things get really bad. There's wars, there's earthquakes, there's God is judging the world for their sin. And it's a bad time to be around. In fact, it's so bad that he says no life would be saved had not God come in and put a stop to it. So unless God puts a stop to it, which he will, no life would be saved. Now, this is the idea that there could be a disaster that it would not only wipe out all human life, but all life on the planet was unfathomable to Jesus' followers. How could that even happen? How could it even? How can you have an army that's going to have the kind of power to inflict this kind of damage in the first place when you have to get there on horse and on foot? And yet now it's not so hard to imagine. Now we think of our earth as kind of on the tipping point where it wouldn't take much to just push it over and make it uninhabitable. There are people who believe that it wouldn't take much just to make the earth too hot for life to be on it. Or maybe there's too much radiation from a nuclear war for life to exist. That's not hard to imagine these days. But for them, where would they got to be thinking, wow, I don't know how this is going to happen. If Jesus is saying it, though, it must be true, but I don't know how it's going to happen. Now it's not so hard to imagine. You see how when I said, not only time-wise we're closer than Matthew was, but technology-wise, it's not hard to imagine these things happening these days. So Jesus goes on, he says, if anyone says to you, behold, here is the Christ, or there he is, do not believe him. For false Christs and false prophets will arise and will show great signs and wonders, so as to mislead, if possible, even the elect. Behold, I have told you in advance, so that if they say to you, behold, he is in the wilderness, do not go out, or behold, he's in the inner rooms, do not believe them. For just as the lightning comes from the east and flashes to the west, so will the coming of the Son of Man be. Wherever the corpse is, there will be vultures. There the vultures will gather. So he's talking about these false prophets and false Christs. They're coming. And not only are they going to come and have false teachings that will convince people, he says they're going to do signs. They're going to perform signs and wonders so as, if possible, to mislead even the elect. These supernatural miracles that these false prophets in the end times will be able to do to mislead people. He says if someone says to you, they're over there, Christ has come back and he's over here, or Christ has come back and he's over there, and that guy's doing miracles, don't buy it. Just because you see a crowd gathered around somebody, just because you see somebody teaching, just because you see somebody even doing some miracles, don't buy it. I'm not here yet. They're going to be misleading people. We have to understand the truth because Jesus is not going to contradict the Bible. We have to understand it. That way we can recognize these false teachers. He says, I've told you in advance. I'm telling you in advance so you don't miss this. So that you don't get the idea that I'm not going to sneak back into history here. When Christ came the first time, he started small. He started in the backwater part of a backwater part of the Roman Empire. And he built his ministry there. He says, when I come back the second time, it's going to be like lightning flashing from the east to the west. It's going to be big, it's going to be fast, and everyone's going to know about it. You're not going to have to wonder, is that the Christ? I've told you in advance, pay attention to what I'm saying. He goes on to talk about his return. He says, immediately after the tribulation, that 7-year period of those days, the sun will be darkened and the moon will not give its light and the stars will fall from the sky and the powers of the heaven will be shaken. And now, I don't know that the stars are actually going to fall. When you read about the tribulation in Revelation, it's very clear that it's probably an atmospheric issue. There's dust in the atmosphere. It dims the light by a third. Then the sign of the Son of Man will appear in the sky, and all the tribes of the earth will mourn, and they will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of the sky with power and great glory. And he will send forth his angels with a great trumpet, and they will gather together his elect from the four winds, from one end of the sky to the other. A big thing is going to happen. He says, all the tribes of the earth were going to mourn. Wait a minute. Why are the tribes of the earth mourning here? You would think that they'd be happy that the king has come. He's talking to people who would be, right? But he's talking about the tribes of the earth. the people who are left during this tribulation who don't believe in God, who don't want Christ to return, who don't want to have anybody rule over their lives except for them. And so now they're going to be proven wrong. They're going to be shown that Christ exists, that they've been told about him and they should have followed him, and now he's here. That's why they're mourning. You don't want to be one of the people who are mourning in this scenario. And then he goes on and talks about the sky opening up and the great power and glory and these angels and these trumpets. What does that mean? It's going to be pretty hard to miss. There's no doubt when Christ returns, you're not going to be reading about it on the internet a month later and say, "What? When did that happen?" That's not going to surprise you later on. It's going to happen and you're going to know it. Everybody's going to know it. It's not going to be a shocker they read later. You're going to know right now. So you don't have to question. "I told you in advance," he says. "This is what's going to happen." And that's why all this time that people spend digging into prophecies and trying to figure out this or that or trying to recognize this sign or that time, I think a lot of that is a waste of time, because you're not going to miss it. You're not going to miss that. It's going to happen and it's going to be a big thing. He says, "Learn the parable from the fig tree. When this branch has already become tender and it puts forth its leaves, you're going to know that summer is near. So you too, when you see all these things, recognize that he is near. He's right at the door. I say to you, this generation will not pass away until all these things take place. Heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will not pass away." He's saying, look, when you see the leaves come out on a fig tree, you know summer's coming, right? Well, when you see these things happening, when you see this abomination of desolation, you know the end is coming. And he says this generation is not going to pass away. He's not talking about this current generation of these disciples. He's talking about the generation that sees the abomination of desolation. When that generation sees that, they're going to know that that generation is not going to pass away before the end. So sometimes when we get prophecy, we're like, when's he talking about this happening? When is this going to happen? We don't know. And it can be a few years in the future, like we saw earlier. It can be 1,000 years in the future. We don't know. But he says, when you see these things happening, you know the end is coming quick. That generation is not going to go away until all the rest of the stuff has taken place. And he says, heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will not pass away. This is interesting for a lot of reasons. First, he says heaven and earth will pass away. In the West, we think of time as linear. We think of the time has a beginning and it's going to have an end, and that's what Jesus is teaching here. But then, they didn't think of time that way. They thought of time as cyclical. It's a wheel. It keeps happening. They thought of it like the seasons. The seasons come and they go and they come back, right? In time, everything happened. It was going to happen again. That was very popular philosophy in most religions of the time. Most people believed that, especially in Rome. One of my favorite sets of books is called The Wheel of Time. And as you can imagine, that's a popular theme in the book, is that time is cyclical and things just happen over and over again. And I heard an interview with the author one time. And they asked him if he believes that, and he says, "I hope not. I hope that's not true." He says, "If that's true, then we have no way of getting out. We have no way of making things better. Everything's just going to happen again. Everything we do, nothing matters." And what Jesus is telling us is that time will have an end, and the things that we do matter. In fact, the things that we do will affect that end. That's good news for us. That means the things that we do are significant. It's not just going to be forgotten and then somebody else is going to come along and do the same thing again. And we've already doing the same things that other people have done. Time is moving forward to this point. And he says, time will end. Heaven and earth will pass away. But my words, he says, are going to last forever. Jesus' words are scripture. Jesus' words are God's words. They're not going anywhere. That's pretty profound. And he says, of that day and hour, no one knows, not even the angels of heaven, nor the Son, but the Father alone. So nobody knows exactly the exact time when this is going to happen. only the Father alone. For the coming of the Son of Man will be just like the days of Noah. For in those days before the flood, they were eating and drinking and marrying and giving in marriage until that day, and Noah entered the ark. And then they did not understand until the flood came and took them all away. So will the coming of the Son of Man be. There will be two men in the field. One will be taken away and one will be left. Two women will be grinding at the mill. One will be taken and one will be left. So the first point is, no one knows when this is going to happen. If someone tells you, well, I know when Christ is going to return, you can disregard him. Someone holding up a sign that says the end is nigh, you can disregard that because they don't know. No one knows. He's giving us some signs so that we recognize it when it's happening. But no one knows for sure what day, what the day and the hour that's going to happen. And he talks about it's going to be like Noah, and he says that, well, there will be two men in the field, and one's going to be taken, and one will be left, and two women will be grinding at the mill, and one's taken, and one will be left. What is he talking about here? He's talking about this idea of the rapture, which you may have heard of. That's a big topic at the end of time, when Jesus will come and return, and he'll take away his people who believe in him. The idea of the rapture, the word rapture is not actually in the Bible. It comes from this passage in 1 Thessalonians, which is talking about the end times, and it says, we who are alive and remain will be caught up together with them in the clouds to meet the Lord in the air, and so we shall always be with the Lord. Paul uses this term caught up, and the word rapture comes from that. It's from the Roman Latin translation of the Bible. To be caught up is rapture. And so what he's saying is, at some point during this tribulation, either before or in the middle of it or at the end of it, God's going to come and he's going to take his people and he's going to save them. Now, when is that going to happen? It's not really clear as far as the timetable of the end goes. I personally think that he's going to pull his people out of, that he's going to pull the church out of the world before all this stuff happens. The reason I say that, there's several of them, but he brings up the idea of Noah here. Noah was a guy who followed God, and he was the only one at his time. Everybody else was doing their own thing, and God was going to judge the world. And so what he did was he saved Noah and judged everybody else. That's a common theme in the Bible. The few times when God is going to judge people temporarily in time, like Noah's day, he pulls out his people who are his followers. He did it for Noah. He did it for Lot. And his family, when he judged Sodom and Gomorrah, what did he do? He warned Lot. He says, you got to get out of here because these people have gotten out of hand and I'm going to take care of it. He did it to Rahab when he was going to judge Jericho. He saved her. And I got to believe that he's going to save us too. There's beyond the examples that he gives, Noah specifically, when you think about what the tribulation is about, it's about God judging the planet. And we don't like the idea of God judging our culture. We don't like to be judged. It's interesting. On one hand, nobody likes to be judged. And on the other hand, everybody wants justice. It's kind of, we've got this cognitive dissonance going on where we want justice, but except for, you know, when it comes to me, I want forgiveness. I want to be, nobody judges me, and yet we want everybody else to have justice. It's interesting how we feel that way. One of the biggest complaints is God can't exist because of all the evil in the world. Well, he's going to take care of that evil. That's what the tribulation is all about. He's coming to judge the world. But I know, as a Christian, I put my faith in Christ because I can't earn through my works, through my good deeds, I can't earn eternal life with God, that I deserve that judgment. And yet through Christ, his death on the cross paid that judgment for me. So I've already been judged in a sense. As Christians, we've already been judged in a sense that Christ has been judged for us. And although he was innocent, he took our payment for us, our punishment for us. And so we've been judged. So why would God put us through that again? He's not going to judge us a second time. So there's another reason why I think that this rapture idea is going to happen before the end. So that's what Jesus has to say about the end times. But I want to think about why is he telling people this? What is the purpose of biblical prophecy in the first place? We have this in our culture. We see these science fiction movies and things where there's a prophecy or somebody comes from the future. You ever see the Terminator movies where somebody comes from the future because they're trying to change the past so the future's different, right? And it's a warning and we've got to change things so that never happens. That's not what this is about. This is going to happen. This is not, hey, get your act together or this is going to happen. He did say that a few times to people. In the Old Testament, I think of Nineveh. He sent Jonah to warn Nineveh to change their ways or God was going to judge them, and they did. There's no if clause, though, here. There's no, hey, if the human race can't get their act together, this is what's going to happen, so you better shape up. Nope, this is going to happen. So why tell us? Well, there's a couple of reasons. One, so we know that the Bible is really from God. So we can know the short-term prophecies, the prophecies that have been fulfilled in history, we can look at that and say, yeah, that couldn't have happened otherwise. Do you know how many other religious scriptures have prophecy like that in them? You can count them on one finger, and it's only this one. Christianity is the only one. This Bible is the only one that has prophecy in it for the future. Now, there are other people who thought they could predict the future. They're not in religious scriptures. Most religious scriptures are about rules and about how you behave and how you get closer to yourself or closer to God or whatever, but they're not rooted in history and given prophecy like the Bible does. People like Nostradamus, that he's probably the most famous guy who said he could predict the future, but you read his prophecies and they're so vague and so out there. It's almost like stream of consciousness writing. It doesn't make a lot of sense. But the Bible's not like that. It's very specific. So why tell us that? Well, he wants us to be ready. Jesus says we need to be ready. Therefore, starting in verse 42, be on the alert, for you do not know which day the Lord is coming. Be sure of this, that if the head of the house had known at what time of the night the thief was coming, he would have been on the alert, and you would not have allowed his house to be broken into. For this reason, you must also be ready. For the Son of Man is coming at an hour when you do not think that he will. So he gives us two warnings here. He says, be alert and be ready. The end is coming. There's nothing we can do to stop it. So we need to be alert and we need to be ready. What does that mean? Well, I think a couple of things we can draw from that. And the first one is that we need to have a relationship with Christ. All this judgment is coming on those who don't believe in him. All the end time prophecies, there's this idea of the book of life comes up. It's actually a book that comes up a lot in the Bible. Here it is in Daniel 12. It says, now Michael, at that time, the end time, Michael, the great prince who stands guard over the sons of your people will arise, and there will be a time of distress such as never has occurred since, there are a time of distress such as never occurred since there was a nation until that time, and at that time your people, everyone who is found written in the book, will be rescued. What's he talking about? This is the book he's talking about. Is this book of life? He's talking about the tribulation, the end of time. And he says people whose name who are written in this book, they're going to be rescued instead of being judged. That sounds good. I like that idea. At the end of this, the time, at the end of the tribulation, when Christ returns, there's going to be this judgment. In Revelation 20, it says, I saw a great white throne, and him who sat upon it, from whose presence the earth and heaven fled away, and no place was found for them. I saw the dead and the great and the small standing before the throne, and books were opened. And then another book was opened, which is the book of life. This is the book I was talking about. And the dead were judged from the things which were written in the books according to their deeds. And they were judged, every one of them, according to their deeds. And if anyone's name was not found written in the book of life, he was thrown into the lake of fire. Here's that idea of judgment again. We don't like this. Our culture really doesn't like the idea that God is going to judge people. And yet we really want justice. God does too. God's really interested in justice. And we see here that at some point we're going to have justice. Unfortunately, what we find is that when we demand justice, when we demand God give me what I deserve, we find that he's going to have these books. And written in those books is our deeds. I want justice, God. Okay, well, let's see what you've done. Let's see what you deserve. And what is found in the Bible and in those books is that everyone has sinned. All of us have rebelled against him. Every one of us deserves the death sentence. None of us can work our way to God. None of us are good enough. Because God's standard is perfection. Those books must be some pretty heavy books. And he says, if you want to be judged by your deeds and get what you deserve, great, that's fine. I don't like it, and you're not going to like it either, but I'll give it to you. The only way to get out of that judgment is to have your name written in the book of life. He says, everybody else whose name was not found written in that book of life was thrown into the lake of fire. How do I get my name in there? That's what I want to know. That's the big question, isn't it? Every other religion in the world will tell you, you need to get what you deserve, and so you got to be good. The Bible is the only one that says God will give you what you don't deserve, which is mercy. All you have to do is ask for it. When Christ died on the cross, he did that for you and he did it for me because our sins deserve judgment. He stepped in and took that judgment for you and for me because he loves us so much. And that if you want to have your name written in that book of life, we have to ask him to put it there through Christ. We have to come to him, and I'm not going to ask you to raise your hand or come up here. You can do it right now in your seat and you say, God, I want Christ's death to pay for my sins. I can't work my way to you and I'm giving up on that. I want to live for you because of what you've done for me through Christ. I want Christ's death to apply to my sins. And at that point, God says, okay. And he writes your name in that book and it's in ink and everything. It's not going anywhere. We're all going to sin. All of our sins have already been judged through Christ at that point. So our name is not coming out of that book. I think that's the first step that you can take to be ready. And he goes on and he says, who then is the faithful and sensible slave whom his master put in charge of his household to give them their food at the proper time? Blessed is that slave whom his master finds so doing when he comes. Truly I say to you that he will put him in charge of all his possessions. But that if that evil slave says in his heart, my master's not coming for a long time, and he begins to beat his fellow slaves and eat and drink with drunkards, the master of that slave will come one day, and when he does not, it will come one day when he does not expect him, and at an hour when he does not know, and he'll cut him in pieces and assign him a place with the hypocrites. And in that place, there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. There's something here for those of us who are already Christians. There's something we're called to be doing. And it's not this. Don't just look busy. But a friend of mine sent me this. I was talking about this teaching, and he sent me this week. I thought it was funny. Jesus is coming, so look busy. That's not what he's saying. He's not just saying, like a boss who's coming and looking over your shoulder, and all of a sudden you close your browser, and you stop playing solitaire, and you start doing real work. That's not what's going on here. What is he saying? Well, we have a hint to it. Now, spoiler alert, the biggest part of this application is going to be next week. Chapter 25 is all about the rest of the Olivet Discourse is all about what we need to do to be ready, what we're supposed to be doing in light of these events that are coming up. But he gives us a hint here. He talks about this slave, and the master's gone, and when he gives him work to do, he says the slave should be giving people their food at the proper time. He needs to be taking care of people. The Bible has called, Jesus calls us as Christians to love our neighbors. That means, yes, giving them food when they need it. Yes, taking care of people's physical needs and serving them. But it also means giving them the spiritual food that they need. giving them the truth they need about Christ and his love for them so that they can be saved as well. That's what we're called to be doing as Christians. And we can look at this and say, well, I'm a young man. I got all my life ahead of me. I'm going to spend my time right now looking for myself, looking out for me. We can say that Christ is not coming back anytime soon. I'm not in any hurry. That's what the slave says who gets busted. We only have so much time, and we don't know how much time that is. We should be found doing something. He doesn't say, I give you these prophecies so that when the end times come and you're all out looking around, right? You're all looking for the signs. You're all looking for me. No, I want to find you doing something. That's why he's telling us this. I want to find you doing those things. And there's a reward involved. It's not just a matter of, okay, he told me I need to do something, so I'll do it. You'll find when you do the work of the Lord that he's called you to do, it's very rewarding. And not only that, he says, truly I say to you that he who does these things will be put in charge of all God's possessions. That's amazing. The master who finds his slave hard at work will be put in charge of all his possessions. What does that even mean? I don't know the full extent of what this means. But it's not insignificant. God has got real work for us to do now, and he's got real rewards for us later. And now, there's real things that we can be doing that affect eternity. And he's calling us to be doing those things. And that's what it means to be ready. So next week, we're going to look into that a little deeper. Jesus gives a couple of parables and he talks about what it means to be ready. This is why I'm telling you this stuff. We need to be ready. And so we'll unpack that a little bit more next week. If you're a first-time guest, that's great. I'm glad you're here. We have a couple of books that you can get. One is called How Good Is Good Enough. If you don't think that God judges, or if you think that God judges people when the good people get into heaven, then that book is for you because it talks about how good you have to be. It's a tough book to read, and not that it's hard to read, in that it's hard. The answer is not a good one. God has a pretty tough standard. The other book is called Discovering God, and this one talks about a lot of real evidence that God exists. In fact, I mentioned Daniel predicted to the future, in the future, when Christ would return, or when Christ would come the first time, and enter Jerusalem and be executed. He predicted that around 500 BC, 500 years before it happened. There's a chapter in that book, I think it's chapter 4, that talks about that, and it lays it out to the month when Christ came. It's pretty amazing stuff. So you can pick either of those up for free if you're a guest. All of us should have these cards in our weekly updates that you got when you walked in. These cards are we're going to have a time for question and an answer. And if you have a question or a comment, we're glad to hear it. But if you don't get time to answer that or you don't want to come up and talk to me later, you can fill it out. We'll drop it in the bag when it comes around, and we'll get back to you. The bag is also for us to financially support the church. This is for those of us who think of us as our church, and we want to help pay the bills. If you're a guest, we don't want your money, so feel free to pass that on by. So the kids are in Oasis to 11:45. We do have a few minutes for questions and comments, but I ask that you pick up your kids if you have them in Oasis. Pick them up at 11:45. So we have a few minutes. If you have a question or comment, raise your hand. We'll bring you a microphone, understanding, though, that I am not some kind of end times prophecy scholar. But we'll talk about this, and if you have other questions, if we run out of time, you can always come up and talk to me, too. So we have a question over here somewhere.
No, great teaching, and thank you for this teaching. I know in my walk, when I'm at work and other places where I'm dealing with people who hopefully are seeking God, seems like everybody picks up their Bibles. They read Genesis, they read Revelation, and they're like, what? And they walk away.
Yeah.
So it's teachings like this that really help to flesh out what all that means and show the interrelations. And just it's well timed for me, so thank you.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, it's really easy to just jump into something like Revelation or even this chapter by itself. And I think, what on earth is he talking about even? We need to take the Bible as a whole. There's a reason he gives us these things, and it's to prove that everything else that he says is true. One of those reasons is to, okay, you saw that what I said about Jerusalem is true. Everything else I said was true too. So what else did he say? It's good for us to know those things. Other questions or comments? Anybody else want a house by the lake of fire? No? There's a lot going on. There's a lot involved. I think we have one up here. There's a lot involved here, and sometimes it's hard to process it all. Yeah.
You were talking about how prophecy was unique for the scriptures, and God, I normally don't see too much of a purpose for it, but one of the things that this summer I was realizing is that when God prophesies everything falling apart, mm-hmm. and then it does, that doesn't mean God, it proves that God is still there, mm-hmm. and that he was still there for the Jews. So when Jerusalem was destroyed, he was still there for the Jews. Mm-hmm. And so like this summer, my take-home point for myself was, so then why, when you feel like your life is coming unglued, why don't you believe God is there for you?
Yeah.
Because, you know, you aren't having the walls of, your city is not being attacked. The thing you're going through isn't the big a deal as it was for the Jews. So
yeah.
It kind of, a take-home point for me is that God is in charge of history, and that makes him trustworthy to be in my life.
Yeah. Yeah, there's we're going to have bad things happen, and not that they're not real and not that they're not painful, but you're right, it's not earth-shattering most of the time. So we can trust that God knows what he's doing. He knows all of history, and there's a purpose for us to go through. And you think about the Holocaust, as terrible as that was, it led to Israel regathering. And I don't know that anybody would say that it was worth going through one to get the other, but we do know that God was still with them throughout all those years and to bring them back together. It's amazing. Yeah.
In my daily reading, I've been in Old Testament for a good couple of months now. And one of the things that I've been, it's for me, it's very difficult to read the Old Testament. I want the New Testament where it's love, 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 love.
Yeah.
You know, and so Old Testament, it's there. And so one of the things I asked God to do was open my eyes to that love in the Old Testament.
Mm-hmm.
So I've been in Jeremiah for the past month, and it's one of the things God keeps showing me is his plea to people, just turn to me. Mm-hmm. I have to judge because I'm a God of justice. I love you, and come and talk to me, know me. Yeah. And his heart, and one of the things that struck me reading through, you know, like Genesis and Leviticus even, and now Jeremiah, is his plea for people. I am here, know me.
Yeah.
And that's true of us today. One of the things I was journaling this morning is the same God who was pleading with people, just know me, turn to me. I am God worth knowing, is the same God today. And that same plea to the people here, to us, and the people we put in our lives, is he's pleading, I'm the same God, know me.
Yeah.
And that's really struck me just through this, is again, one of the things that Jesus is saying, I love you, and I want as many people, I want heaven to be filled with as many people as possibly could be there. And that is one of the reasons why he tells us this, so that when we get to heaven, wow,
yeah.
You know, it's going to eternity is going to be phenomenal with how many people are going to be there.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, that you look at the passage at the end of chapter 23, right before he gets into all this stuff, and Jesus is lamenting. He's looking at Jerusalem, and he's in tears because he loves them. And yet they won't listen. He sent all these prophets, and they've ignored them, and they're ignoring him now. And he sees the destruction of Jerusalem coming, and he's moved into tears. He's not gleeful that, aha, now you're going to get it. He's sad because they have to be judged. God has to judge them, but he doesn't want to because he loves them so much. And that's where it is with us. He loves us so much. And all that tribulation is, part of that is to get people's attention. Even if God pulls out the church before that happens, there's going to be believers there because of the prophecy. They're going to see, holy cow, everything I heard and didn't believe was true. And they're going to be Christians in that time. And yet they're going to go through some tough times, but he loves them so much, and he loves the world so much. And one of the things C.S. Lewis points out, that nobody goes to hell except people who want to go there. That's the thing. People choose. God says, all you have to do is come to me, and it's free and it's easy. It's the people who choose to lead their own lives, and they don't want to bow, and they want to be their own kings. Those are the people who end up going to hell, because they're the only ones who don't want God in their lives. And so the people who go to hell are the ones who choose to be there, and then God has to judge them. He lets them have their free will, and it's sad, and it saddens him. It saddens us. It saddens him even more so, because he loves us so much. Well, I'll tell you what. We got one more, and then we'll pray.
Yeah, Adam, thanks for the teaching today. This wheel of time concept is, I don't know, it's not unique, but there is some truth to that.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, the Christians being tormented and persecuted. And today you see a lot of that going on, not specifically with Christians in this country, but say you have a particular ideology about political stuff. If you express that, say at work, you put your job in jeopardy if your boss is of the opposite. And the anger is unreal. I've seen it before, but not like it is, where you can't say what you really think because your car might be keyed, tires punctured, your windows broken out of your car, and it's like, oh my goodness, what's going on?
Mm-hmm.
And so my question to you is, given that scenario, the Christian way to be in response to that, you can't open your mouth because of you're going to be persecuted, if you will. It's like, okay, I'm a Christian, so I want to, the guy who's going to do that to my car or my house or something, I want to beat him before he does that.
Right.
It's like, no, that's not the Christian way to do it. I need to love that person. And so I guess maybe that I should be expressing my love for that person before I say what I really believe about my thoughts.
Yeah, I think a lot of times Christians are afraid of that, or they want to demand their rights. They don't want to, and so they're spouting off about their faith because they want to be heard. They want to be recognized that their beliefs are valid. We don't need the world to tell us our beliefs are valid. We've got God doing it. And so that frees us up to not have to demand our rights from the world, because we're not going to have them. Only we have everything we need through Christ and through God. And so we should check our motivations before we start spouting off our beliefs. Instead of trying to judge people or demand that they look at us and affirm our beliefs, we should, I love you, and I want you to know this. And if you don't want to hear it, fine, but I'm still going to love you. And then our actions can speak way louder than our words. And once they hear, see our actions, maybe our words will, maybe they'll want to hear more of the words later. But yeah, but Christ told us. I told you in advance. It's going to happen. The people don't want to hear some stuff. They don't want to believe in Christianity. Whatever. That's fine. And that's going to happen. But it's just stuff. It's all going to burn up in the end anyway. We've got eternity with him. That's the real goal. All right. I'm going to pray, and then we'll be done for today. If you do have other questions or comments, feel free to come up afterwards, though. Lord, thank you. You do give us warnings. You do understand history, God. You are the God of history. You are not some God of nature. You are in time. You are in our lives with us, and you do want us to listen to you. You do want us to come to you because you love us, and it's hard to see that when we look at all this judgment stuff, but the truth is you love us so much so we don't have to go through that if we choose not to. All we have to do is ask for forgiveness through Christ, and it's so easy for us, and you've made it so welcoming that it's hard to believe people would not want to do that. And yet we get stubborn. So I pray, God, that if there's people here today with questions about that, or they're worried about that tribulation that they come to you, God, in faith, and maybe they talk to some of their Christian friends that are here today and try to get some answers if they have questions. Amen.